Welcome back, everyone. So this is the vendor panel. This is probably Mick Kirsten's dream panel. Okay. We have here, I guess we'll all introduce ourselves, Tom Grant, who favored us with his keynote this morning, is going to be our moderator. You've got from mixed circles of market share, I think a dominant bunch of green from the industry represented up here in terms of vendors. And we can probably, I don't know, Tom, how do you want to do this? Should we start with introductions?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you know who I am. I'm Sam, and you met me, and I'm the product owner for Visual Studio Strategy for Microsoft, and you've probably had enough of me by now.
Hello, I'm John Wiegand, and I'm from IBM, and I'm the Rational Chief Architect, come from Eclipse Heritage, so I was the original project lead on the Eclipse project, and then transitioned into making that an open source project before taking the leadership assignment on the Jazz initiative, which initially focused on Rational Team Concert, which is a developer-centered tool, and now looking across all of the ALM concerns.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Mitchell, and I'm the Managing Director of ThoughtWorks Studios. And we are focused primarily on agile application lifecycle management. So we have a platform for project management, testing, and continuous delivery and agile release management.
Hello, everybody. I'm Melinda Clover, and I am one of the product managers for HP ALM. I've been at HP approximately a year and a half, so a little bit newer to the space. But before that, I actually worked at CA, where I focused on project management and worked on the Clarity product over there.
I'm Mick Kirsten. I'm the. I'm Mick Kirsten. I'm the CEO of Fast Off Technologies. Like John, my history is with Eclipse. When John transferred out of IBM, I joined the project about exactly 10 years ago and created Eclipse Milan to capture some of the ALM concerns inside the IDE and then move beyond that into our business around ALM integration and traceability with Fast Off.
Great. Well, why don't we dive in? I have some questions for you all about tools related matters, and I also have some non tools related matters. So just to frustrate the tools people, I will start with the non tools questions. But just in general, kind of what you've learned about ALM from working with customers. So first question I had was just in interacting with your customers, what do you find are the strongest and the weakest parts of their ALM strategy, and how does that picture differ from maybe 5 years ago?
I'll start. I think the stories that we've told around ALM have been consistent over the last 5 years. The stories have been very impressive. The only problem is they weren't true. And so what was happening is people were hearing great stories about the business value and the promise about what could be achieved with ALM, but the results were fairly disappointing. Mm-hmm. The part that's different over the last few years is some of those promises are starting to be not just tantalizing hints, but actually providing real value to our customers. And so now we're starting to see some new approaches and some new things that are providing real value.
I think going back really to your keynote this morning, Tom, talking about the shifting in styles and ways that we think, and I think the past generation of application lifecycle management was very much focused on providing or implementing business management or industrialization type management processes for software. And I think we've learned now, I mean, it was a very good story, but I think we've learned now that doesn't work. And I think particularly for many large organizations who are really struggling with creating responsiveness through software, who are using software to generate revenue and to open up new business models and new channels, the speed with which we need to get software created and out the door and in the hands of real users is just, it's orders of magnitude difference really than even 5 years ago. So I think for application lifecycle management, this means that we need a whole new set of tools that really facilitate this very fast, you know, continuous experimentation and discovery. Get it out there, try it out, see what happens, and take feedback from customers and steer as you go. And I think a whole new set of tools are really required to kind of facilitate that type of approach.
Yeah, I mean, we talk with a lot of customers who are in varying ranges of maturity when you think about it. They have wide variety of tools that they have in place, and they're trying to make all these tools work together. Other things that we notice is a shift in methodologies. I mean, if you go back 5-7 years, there wasn't a lot of agile practice out there, right? It was very cut and dried how people did software development. And now with the introduction of Agile and people adopting Lean and Kanban and all these different processes, you know, they're having to shift and change. Even the business itself is having to shift its processes as software development morphs into these different areas. So we're just trying to figure out how best to address the wide range of customers out there with their heterogeneous suite of products and make all those work together better.
Yeah, I think a big shift that we saw, and I think is, like John, you're saying that there were these things that weren't true, they're becoming true, this emphasis on, and I guess Cindy, what you said, this too, this change and shift to support developers as, you know, as a key stakeholder in ALM. When you look at the more tailored approach and you know, in the rationally unified process, they weren't more like a cog that was an implementation detail of ALM. And when you treat them that way, they don't behave exactly the way that you want, and you end up with rebellions like Agile, which we're still adjusting around. So this focus on developers, you now see that as a core part of the TFS or the NVS or and the RTC stacks. So I think that's been a really good change, and I think part of supporting that is supporting heterogeneity, because developers, once you let them choose their own tools, they do, and a lot of organizations have. You know, we've got this proliferation of Jira, which is completely disconnected from these ALM stacks, and it's only got this base issue tracking feature set. So. Mm.
Yeah, I think a big difference I see when I do executive briefings, which I do a lot of on the other side of this building, between now and 5 years ago, is 5 years ago, I was always encouraging people to put Agile on the agenda with customers, and now I never have to do the encouraging. It's always it comes on the agenda from customer requests, and they want to hear about, you know, Agile. How do you guys do Agile? How should we think about Agile, consistent with you know, your Dobbs surveys and the like? And so it's the awareness is there. I think the water scrum fall kind of how do we fit this in? And yeah, we're sort of half there and we're struggling is very much the state of the market. You do have this tension between the bottom-up push for Agile and the top-down push for, but we worry about time and money and accountability and quarterly reports to shareholders and all those kinds of things, and how do we fit them together? And it's the tension's real, and we need to address both.
Are executives getting better at understanding software development? I mean, it seems like we had for the first time at the Agile conference, an executive track where executives came in and shared what they were hoping to see happen from Agile adoption. But, you know, in ALM in general, when you walk over to the executive briefing center or when you're interacting with executives, are you finding that they really kind of get what software development is capable of doing?
I think so. I think it's partially a generational thing. So, frankly, I think, you know, every executive today has a computer and does email, and it's not, you know, this isn't something that, you know, is novel and to be avoided, and their kids have computers, and they're more aware, and it is something you use to differentiate your business, and I think ideas like core and context are commonplace, so I think it's no longer, you know, we need to ring fence and control those developers. So I do think that's been a change that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. I definitely would agree with that. I think that I would add that you know, the amount of complexity involved in running any business today is orders of magnitude what it was even 10 years ago. And a lot of that has come from, obviously, introduction of new technology. We're all globally interconnected now. There's, you know, all kinds of factors going on, social, economic, and otherwise, that is just making it a much harder world to survive in. And I think for a lot of organizations, certainly the more kind of early adopting organizations, they see software as a way for them to innovate and to stay ahead and to get ahead. Those companies and those organizations, you see executives really developing a very deep understanding of software and the importance of software and software quality on their ability to generate revenue, to develop relationships with their customers, and to really create change and stay in the market. If you're a retailer today, you have an organization in your company, a dot-com organization, that's competing with all kinds of new startups, whether it's Zappos or an Amazon or anybody else. And, you know, you have to understand, you know, very deeply how software can impact your business and can help you compete in that market space. So we see a lot of executives who are really, you know, taking the time to roll up their sleeves and dig in and understand software and good software management practice.
How often do you see those that don't? I mean, I certainly talk to Forrester clients where they have a problem about their management expects too much, you know, as one scenario, right? They expect, you know, on time, on budget is what they're thinking of. Of course, that's not necessarily the best measure of everything, but they see, you know, that they, you know, want to just keep pushing harder and harder on the development team. They want to apply management principles that may be counterproductive. They don't seem to be aware of the unrealism of some of that. I mean, how often are you seeing that, and is that a soluble problem? Maybe here's a question: is ALM maybe even a little dangerous in giving a false sense to those people of control?
Yeah, I think Tom, we've had lots of discussions around in our deployments at early adopters of Agile. So you see, Agile is different when it's driven from the executive office. Mm-hmm. It's a different flavor than when it's driven, you know, bottoms up from engineering. When it's driven bottoms up from engineering, the executive office is freaking out that they're going to have these black holes in their delivery process, and they're going to have to be communicating requirements, you know, every 2 weeks, not every 6 or 3 months. When it's driven from the executive office, you've got developers who are now seeing Agile as a, you know, potentially a micromanagement technology for having to report every task and thing that they do and break down everything. And they'll still continue with their existing behavior and break down their tasks at the end of a sprint or worse yet, at the end of a release. And so I think there's just this really interesting disconnect as Agile is maturing for larger scales, right? You've got 100 motivated developers who are excited about the Scrum course they just took. It's different. If you've got 5,000 of them who couldn't care less about, you know, the latest Agile literature, and they're being told to adopt Agile, they, you know, we've often seen it perceived as this technology that gives them no value. So I think the tools that we make today have to bridge that gap. They have to give value to the developer in adopting Agile. The developer has to have, you know, more control over their workday, not feel like it's this big brother technology for monitoring them. Because there is fundamental value to the developer in the Agile process. They're meant to be empowered in it.
And so really the combination of a top-down executive support for the transformation, combined with the development teams taking ownership of how the tools are used and how ALM is really implemented, is how you get the real successful deployments.
Yeah, I mean, if you can put, you know, an executive cares about numbers when you get right down to it, right? You know, if they're going to see costs going down, if they're going to see products going to market faster and revenues increasing in different product areas, then they're going to get pretty excited about whatever method is being used internally to some degree. So, you know, as long as we can provide the appropriate metrics and reporting and roll up all this information across these different tools, I think executives tend to jump on board pretty quickly.
Yeah, that I think Tom brings up an interesting point. If the metrics on time and on budget, and when the value that Agile is giving you is that you're more lean and delivering more of what the customer wants, and it's actually a better product in the end that lasts longer, I'm not sure that the executives have all those metrics in place at this stage. I don't know what everyone else thinks.
Well, it is. I mean, the question of actionable metrics versus vanity metrics is a great question. And I mean, lean startups kind of bringing this to consciousness and the idea of a build, measure, learn loop as something that we need to build into our processes is something that I do think is becoming a current meme. I think some get it. I think there's certain things that do work. Executives get the idea of technical debt because mm-hmm. they've certainly encountered the side effects of it. So, you know, you don't find people coming saying, I'm for technical debt, right? You know, I'm for, you know, more impediments. I'm for broken flow of value. You know, so you can talk about things in terms that make sense for, in executive terms that are very much consistent with agile values and consistent with what execs care about, and make that connection so that it doesn't become a let's use metrics as a new way to implement command and control top down.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I sense the measurement side to be one where we're going from the looking back at what happened so we can see what was there into a case where we're turning into predictive measures so you can get a flavor of what's going to happen next and prescriptive possibly when we start becoming imaginative. And as those things happen, that completely lines up with your thought, Melinda, which is that's business value and easy to absorb.
Well, and we do get customers actually asking us about predictive analysis with test management. You know, they want to be able to take, you know, information and be able to predict, well, what would happen if I run this test again in the future with these particular parameters in place. So people are already starting to go down that path of how can we put this together and then feed that back up to the organization to predict what's going to happen.
I'll just share an example that we've seen is in support organizations where you can look at some of the analysis on the defects coming in and how they're being handled to determine whether what's happening in the support organization is managing to the metric versus right. actually dealing with the problems that are there.
Right. So you kind of segued a little bit into my next question, talking about, you know, having top-down and bottom-up sort of impetus for ALM. Are there other signs that ALM initiatives will succeed or fail that you would, for this audience here, cite for them?
I think like anything, certainly, and I come at ALM from the angle of agility, but obviously you have to have the bottom and the top meet, but I guess having a strategic imperative and clarity about what it is that you're trying to achieve. So I see a lot of failed large-scale agile transformations, for example. And one of the biggest reasons why these large-scale top-down agile transformations fail is because there isn't a clear strategic imperative for the organization across the board to achieve a high degree of responsiveness or agility. And so you're failing to tie, you know, whatever it is you're doing in an organization to the strategic imperative and you know, what the need is for the company is a key one. So why are you doing ALM? Why do you need ALM? Are you trying to get better control, better quality, faster results? And so being clear about, you know, in implementing any tool set, any approach, any methodology in an organization, I guess, in what are you trying to achieve and what are you trying to achieve in which parts of the organization? It may be different for different parts of the organization. So some parts of the organization may have a need for agility. Others may have a need for extreme auditing controls. And I guess allowing through the implementation of whatever it is you're doing, implementing a new ALM platform, being clear about what it is you're trying to achieve in those areas and allowing for these heterogeneous examples. So, you know, what works in Department A may not be what works in Department B and may not make sense in Department B. And so allowing for this kind of heterogeneous nature of a rollout is actually really quite an important piece. Things get killed when you start to just blindly implement any sort of pattern or set of constraints across an organization. So I think tying it to strategic imperative and allowing for this heterogeneous kind of continuous discovery and learning approach is extremely important.
Any other red flags, green flags you'd want to cite?
Well, I'd say there, you know, a smell is anything where people are acting without understanding why. I mean, one of the great things in the Scrum Guide is inspect and adapt. Mm-hmm. And if people are not inspecting and adapting and asking, how do we get better at this, and are we You know, are we delivering better flow? Are we getting better at reducing waste? Are we becoming more transparent? How does this relate to customer value? And so on. And tying this back to the value being delivered, it's a smell. And if they're not exhibiting pride of craftsmanship and trying to get better at what they're doing, it's a smell. If they're doing this, you know, because someone said so in Rule 33, it's a smell. And so, you know, all of those things lead to, you know, dysfunction. And it's the same dysfunction you have any time you have a prescriptive metric.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll add another two, just a straight from your talk this morning, Tom, the traceability. I think, you know, if you lack traceability, you had traceability before an agile transformation, and you had a, you know, it may have been a more traditional waterfall process, and you've taken it out with agile. Mm-hmm. By disconnecting from whatever it was, your PPM tools, your requirements management tools, which are still in place, because the rate of change in that part of the organization is smaller, or is lower than the rate of change in engineering, you now might be on your way to failing with your ALM modernization. And similar for automation. I think if you know, another one of those slides that you had this morning, if you've fallen behind on automation because, say, you've got heterogeneity, you had better automation with a single vendor stack, again, you're on your way to failure.
Yeah. By the way, the lack of purpose is something, you know, I certainly see all the time. You know, and you know, why is this not succeeding as an initiative? Well, have you explained to anybody why you're doing it? You know, what's the outcome you hope? Just, you know, maybe obvious to you, but not obvious to the people signing the checks necessarily. So to shift gears just a little bit. I mean, another issue I know that ALM has been trying to address is the challenge of offshoring. And geographic distribution of teams in general, but offshoring particularly seems to be vexing, right? And there are days, certainly, when I'm answering questions about it that I'm tempted to say, maybe we've gotten as good as we're going to ever get with offshoring. We're going to get the most no more great productivity gains out of offshoring, that the collaboration challenges are just going to kind of stay in place. Feel free to disagree or agree with that. I mean, do you think that if as ALM advances, that the problems with offshoring are going to or stay roughly where they are?
Well, you know, there's a Microsoft research paper from 2 years ago by Nachi Nagapan, where Nachi looked at the Windows code base and escape defects, and analyzed the impact of geographic distribution, and found that all of geographic distribution was explained away by organizational distance. So, in other words, he said the entire dysfunction that you would account for by saying, oh, well, the problem is that these two teams were on different continents, could be explained equally well by saying, oh, they were three steps removed from the next nearest common manager, and was accounted for by organizational distance. Now, you can argue it was a special case. It got ACM Best Paper of the Year, mm-hmm. So it got some academic attention at least. We try to run synchronized sprints between here, well, actually across teams that are now split on both coasts and in India and a few other places. So we're trying internally to do distributed agile ourselves. We do things a little bit differently, so we use a lot of things like recording sprint reviews on video. Mm-hmm. And distributing them that way, so not everyone needs to stay up all night and those kinds of things. There's a tax. I don't think it's as bad as it's been claimed. Mm-hmm. I think you do need to accept the common culture. There is a certain amount of teaming. You do need a certain amount of FaceTime on at least a yearly cycle.
Yeah.
Can be done.
Well, I was just going to say, I think actually here's an area where there is room for improvement on the tools, and in particular collaboration type of products. And also cultural changes like adopting, say, video conferencing and things like that, which everybody seems to have those in their organizations, but I don't know how well they're actually used in practice. But it's interesting because I had a conversation with a customer the other day who specifically pointed out, we've done everything that we can do as far as reducing costs. We have moved into all these different geographic areas. And, you know, they felt like things are running pretty smoothly there, but now they're looking to do more. You know, what else can we do to make things, you know, move better? And I think that gets back to potentially improvements in tools and collaboration products.
I'll just add to that. I don't think offshoring is over. I don't think we've reached the maximum level of productivity that
Thank
we
you.
Can get to.
I can stop the swearing now.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, I mean, we continue, just like Melinda says, we just continue to push the envelope and innovate around it. Well, a couple of the things that we've done more recently is start to align the offshoring region more closely to the time zones in the onshoring region. So Brazil overlaps nicely with the U.S., India overlaps nicely with the U.K. and Europe, China overlaps nicely with Australia, so some of it, I mean, you can't take away from the fact that people just want to enjoy their work. They want to come to work every day and enjoy themselves. They want to know the people that they work with. They want to exchange, you know, information and enjoy their time. And I think that's one of the things that we certainly struggle with. We were, you know, some of the original pioneers of this distributed agile stuff. And I think one of the big things that we struggle with as we refined it, it's just like, it takes its toll on people. People get tired, they get fatigued, you know, it's like, or you spend the first hour every day catching up with whatever happened, you know, to 8 hours away from you, and you spend the last hour every day packaging everything up nicely so someone can pick it up from where you left off, and you don't have that, you know, chance to build relationships with people. It's not as fun, quite honestly, and we really just started to fatigue some of our key people on either end of the equation, and so we started looking for better ways where we didn't have to do that. And so one key thing that we do is, you know, have video screens on all the time. So if we have a team working in Chicago and a team working in Sao Paulo in Brazil, there just is constant real-time video exchange. So when someone has a question or something, they just walk up to the video screen and they just have a conversation, almost as if they were in the same room together. So, I mean, these sound like cheap little trivial things, but they actually make a huge difference as far as your enjoyment of your day, your ability to feel productive, and like you're doing meaningful work on a daily basis. And I think that's a lot of that kind of stuff is really the key to good, solid software development teams, is your ability to just feel productive and move things forward. And so there's still a lot more of that kind of stuff, I think, to come.
One thing we noticed is the difference between globally distributed teams and globally dispersed teams is the term we used, is the random spray of a team around the world is painful and not at all effective. But if you actually get some degree of co-location and common mission, then leveraging these additional technologies can be effective and promising.
I'm fascinated by Sam's early point that the organizational structure has more impact than the geographical, or equal or more impacted than geographical distribution. And you know, I think what's been really interesting about this is that when we look at, when we analyze the ALM stack for an organization, and you know, they show us these slides where they have, you know, this tool over here that came, this is the outsourced people are getting requirements and Word documents, doing their work and their own open source tool, and we're bringing back into our stack that's you know, working in an enterprise ALM tool. And what really resonated for me about that is that we see that exact same kind of disconnect between the organization and who they're outsourcing to as that organization and a company they just acquired who's stuck on, you know, their ALM stack. And I think if your ALM tool doesn't see into the software, you know, the evolution of the software that you're building on, if you don't have, you're doing Agile and they're getting requirements every 3 months and you have no ability to track what they do and they're just, you know, they cover their ass at the end, then you've got this problem. So we've had this interesting practice because we've done a bunch of services work for a bunch of ALM vendors. So when the first one that we did was, or one of the first ones was Atlassian, while we had our own stack, we built all of their tools on Jira. So we were using their project, an instance of their project management tool inside our organization, and they could track it with the additional tools they run on top of Jira. With ThoughtWorks, we tracked the whole project that was done within TaskUp on Mingle. So they had the same kind of traceability for effectively an outsourced project that another organization was doing as they had for their own. And it's not, you know, it's not feasible to have an outsourced organization adopt your tool for every project. But again, I think this gets back to having the ALM tools talk to each other so that you are not consumed, you're not getting traceability in the form of filtered information every 2 weeks in the form of an email. You're using the reporting tools that you have in your enterprise, your agile tool to see into the life cycle of an outsourced project. And similar for open source, right? It's not just outsourcing. A lot of organizations are consuming open source SDKs. They're now depending on how that open source SDK, be it jQuery or some Apache component, is going to evolve over time. You need to see into the life cycle of that thing. Otherwise, you're creating patches in your own internal stream of things that are about to become incompatible. And again, you're getting a lot of benefit from an outsourcing to open source, but unless you're plugging into the ALM to the life cycle of what you're consuming, you're getting this problem.
But even without the tools issue, I think the organizational distance is significant. I mean, not surprisingly, the scenario of we have an offshore team, we have some project manager from the offshore team who sits in our office, we find the things that are happening in the offshore team mysterious, okay, perhaps then you should reconsider that particular approach. You have institutionalized organizational distance in that particular scenario.
Yeah, I really think that the offshoring question often hides the organizational distance issue. So I think Conway's law is correct, that organizations are doomed to ship software that reflects their organizational structure. And the corollary to Conway's law is, therefore, structure your organization according to the software you want to end up shipping. Uh-huh. And if you're working with multiple organizations in the chain, structure them according to the way you want the software to end up. And I do think it's possible to have teams that are geographically distributed work together closely if they are organizationally close. And I think it's quite possible to have teams that are in one building work in thorough dysfunction if they have completely different reporting chains. And I think most of us in the room have probably seen lots of examples of both.
All right, a somewhat different question. So it struck me today, I was listening to the excellent presentation on UX this morning, and we're trying to get people to have shorter intervals, and we're packing a lot in those intervals, right? We're saying we're going to have just enough requirements in order to get people working. We want to, to define the work units in the backlog and get them going, and there'll be just enough information there to be, meaningful as a starting point. And then we're going to pull in earlier the UX work that's going to happen. Oh, and by the way, that also means pulling in more feedback from typical users in that short interval. That seems to be, a little scary maybe, that particular formula. How can you juggle all that, in these ever shorter intervals we're advising people to develop software in? Is that a legitimate fear? Is there a good solution to that? Or have you seen anything work especially well?
You mean just specifically as far as making a tight loop?
Yes, a very tight loop around.
Yeah, I mean, continuous delivery has some good lessons for you in there. Definitely it's much harder to contemplate the idea of breaking things down into very small chunks, and it's very hard to think about, how to do things in the small. I think it's an absolute requirement for any organization that's using software to engage with their customers, to experiment with new business models and new channels to market. I think we have to figure this problem out. And there's a lot of great thinking happening, continuous delivery. I think the DevOps movement is really helping us to understand how we can, in very tight, small increments, release very small changes to our software and understand the impact of those changes on our users and use that as a roadmap to guide us in the way that we move our products forward. So, you know, there's a lot of enabling technologies that have come to the fore that allow us to do this kind of stuff. Obviously, all the cloud stuff and the tooling that comes with all the DevOps and the ability to automate and automated functional testing, and you know, there's any number of sets of tools that have really come into their own in the last sort of 3 years time frame that enable this type of very small, rapid experimentation. And I think, going back to what Sam says, I think in most organizations that I see struggling with this, it's much more of an organizational problem than an issue with tooling or with technical capability. And I will say, I guess the organizations that I see getting this right and doing it really, really well have really cracked product management. And I don't mean product management as in like vendors sitting up on this panel, but product management in an enterprise context. So product management for an online retailer or for an online travel website. Organizations that have established, recruited actually, and enabled and established product management as a profession and have it attached P&L responsibility to that product management role within their organization, figure this stuff out, and they figure it out very, very quickly. So that's probably the pattern that I've seen in that regard, to keeping that loop really tight and bringing all this stuff in.
Well, go ahead.
I think one of the key things too is to keep it small. You know, as Cindy mentioned, I think so often when we're doing development or building out some new application, the tendency is we're going to deliver this large, monolithic, overbearing piece of software. And then if you're trying to do that with agile processes, it's just not going to work, right? You have to break it down into small pieces in order to be successful. You know, as Mickey pointed out in her talk today, you have to do user testing. That's going to take a day or a week, right? So you can't be testing a huge module of an application. You have to be focused on a particular feature or functionality.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to stick with UX for a moment, back in the old days, right, you'd develop a product, and then at the very end of the cycle, you would throw a UI on top of it. It was like a tarpaulin on top of a big pile of junk. Can we just declare that model dead? Is that feasible anymore? Should we just be telling people here in the audience that it's time to embrace design thinking and let's postpone the inevitable and really kind of build software from the user's perspective to whatever extent the UI or the UX is going to be significant in it from the very beginning?
Can I say yes?
Okay. Great. Moving on.
I honestly think there's a lot for us in the design thinking stuff. The IDEO people have been thinking about design for a lot longer and a lot deeper than a lot of the software people have. And there's some really, great lessons in there for us about how we facilitate a culture of design in our own organizations. And, there are a lot of patterns for doing this stuff in the small, whether it's canary releasing or feature toggles, or there are known patterns for how do I do this stuff in the small. And I do think, the organizations that are going to spring ahead in this regard are going to, you're going to see a lot more design thinking. I really believe that facilitating design as a culture is an important piece of this.
I see this as just another example of a silo that's unacceptable. And as we bring the UX expertise into the team and working in the iterations, it just pays off.
Yeah, just one thing I wanted to add is I think what's been working for some categories of applications, what's been working really well is I completely agree with the points on continuous delivery, but hooking up continuous delivery to a customer feedback loop. So I think we've got a lot of these mechanisms, like the Office user experience program, right? Like I've always used the beta of Office, and I like clicking, whether it's the smiley or something more. It's one thing to sit down in the lab with UX people, but that's also has problems in some application domains because you're taking a very small sample. If you're Google or Facebook, you don't have to do that. You've got a hosted application. You just you do the A/B thing like Amazon, and you're getting much better sample of feedback from live users who hopefully are representative. We can't do that for all our applications, but this is exactly, just as Brian Harry pointed out today, he got the user emails more quickly than the monitoring tool would report failures with a hosted TFS. It's the same thing for us with UI and Mylan. If we commit something and it gets built that night, even though it's a desktop application, it's getting auto-updated to all those desktops because we've got auto-update technologies now that work. it's only a click for someone to complain about it, and then they, you know, then to possibly fix it themselves. So that whole you know, connecting up the wisdom of crowds and just broad consumption, as broad as you can, because of some applications you just don't have that breadth, to the continuous delivery loop, so that you're feeding back as much real early adopter feedback into your sprints as you can, I think it's just an amazing combination for increasing the velocity of great user experience.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's both the automated telemetry of feedback, and I think it's the insight you get from actually observing and talking to real people, and it's connecting those so that you get the insight about the whys, why people are clicking here or doing this or what have you, you know, combining where their eyes are moving or what they're saying, why they're confused, what they were expecting with what they're clicking on. And when you can get all that feedback together, that's fantastic. And part of what enables this, frankly, is that we are in a world where there's a lot more stuff you can reuse and connect. We do have services that are there, and we do have open source and reusable services and projects that you can take advantage of now, so you don't have to be stuck after 2 years or 6 months or what have you figuring out what to do. You have the opportunity to do short cycle sprints and quickly get the feedback.
Okay.
Or continuously.
All right. Let me ask you a question about tools. I promised I'd get to tools. What's the hardest part of ALM to address with a tool strategy?
We're all stunned in silence.
I'll try.
There must be
I still think that there's something uncracked in this area of collaboration. So, I mean, software is good software development is a very social activity. So we talk to each other, we share ideas, we share concepts. And, you know, in an ideal world, we would record every conversation that's ever had around a product or an initiative. And we'd have it somewhere, and we'd have it accessible and searchable when we want it and when we need it. And it would always appear in context. When I'm thinking about a requirement, I'd have a recording of all the 10,000 conversations that I've ever had about that requirement, and I'd be able to find what I wanted in there. And so I still think that there's, I mean, and that sounds crazy, but we can do that, actually. The technology is there to be able to do it, and I just feel like there's still this matching of structured and unstructured collaboration that we do all the time on in our team rooms and on our software projects, that the tools still have a ways to go to pick that up. And it's hard. It's hard. It's something that we think a lot about, is just how do we pull together all of the memes, the things that get said, the emails that get sent, the wiki updates that happen, the Word documents, the visual, you know, wireframes, the conversations that happen in a boardroom. How do we bring all of that together and only when we want it? So how do we make that available to us when we want it and when we want to recall it? And that's a hard problem to solve. And so that's an area that we're really focused on with the next generation of our tool set.
I think one of the areas where we have a long way to go is dealing with a hybrid world of lots of existing assets, lots of on-prem operations, a big desire to move faster to the cloud, a big desire to move faster to services, a big desire to do more new, and a lot of things that we want to retire, but we don't really understand. And we don't really know how to get out from under that overhang, or even, you know, how to think about or understand what we've got. And I think, you know, in many cases it's a question of, well, what are going to be the side effects of touching this thing? how can I reduce the amount of cost I have and risk I have with all the keep the lights on activities so that I can move faster on the new, mm-hmm. and really accelerate there.
Any other candidates?
The place I go is on the data integration. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when we look at trying to bring the tools together, we're focusing on this tool and that tool and how can I get them to interplay. And what we really need, in fact, in the examples we've had so far, the question is, how can I get the traceability? How can I get from this requirement to this test case to this description of the deployed configuration? And I think if we can focus more on the data and make that the language that we're all talking about, and really, although we care about tools, because that's what many of us here are providing, I think the data is much more important than the tools, much longer lived than the tools. The data is what lives. The tools can evolve, can go away, but that data really is going to matter in 10, 20, 30. We talked to some of our customers, their data needs to live for 75 years, and it's not something to play around with.
Yes, I've got just a different angle on it. If you, in terms of the things that tools are good at supporting on the ALM side, and things that they're not as good at supporting. If you look at open source ALM and the sorts of projects that have no real-time communication, so by the nature they're purely supported by electronic collaboration mm-hmm. tools, you can look at the things that they're good at and the things that they're bad at. And in the sense I'm getting from the ones that I've taken close looks at is that they're bad at that sort of the product management level things, that sort of the creative processes where you need to have different, more than engineers and team, you have to have, you're creating novel UIs and you have to have a UX and a visual designer and maybe those kinds of people in the room, as well as some business stakeholders that, they're telling you what's feasible, what's not, and that they're tapped into the strategy. Those, you'll see a lot of these open source projects, they're just re-implementing things that were created in either close, in another fashion, where there was that sort of face-to-face uh-huh. collaboration. So, Cindy, with your point with the displays is actually interesting to me, because the way that the Mylan open source project runs is it just runs all asynchronously. It has the one-hour meeting phone call that's just a sync up between all these sub-projects and their leads. But it's other than that, it's 99% asynchronous through comments on work items and tasks and the like. And not really, hardly any email, hardly any IM. For our own projects, it's a bunch of 46-inch displays, and everyone who's remote is showing up on this 46-inch displays, so we're having these real-time dialogues very regularly around product management and the like. Because there's that creative process, it's kind of hard to beat the FaceTime. Mm-hmm.
See, there was that moment of silence, and you all came up with such great answers. that was fantastic.
I still think we need to own tools.
So since you mentioned open source, I mean, what specifically did open source do to change your product strategies? And what has it done? Aside from the obvious, hey, there are these open source tools people are using, let's integrate with them, what else has it done?
I was going to say integration.
Uh-huh.
The obvious one.
There's one thing it did to us, which is there's so much value in that style of development, the working transparently, the sharing the way the development effort is going. And instead of saying that's only something that an open source project can do, why can't a normal commercial project be working in a very transparent way, letting people work just in the real time with the defects as they're being discovered, transparent plans, downloads, feedback loops, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we have started adopting with significant value to us.
Yeah, and we've started incorporating more maybe exploratory testing types of functionality, right? Which is probably a little bit more like maybe some of the open source and allowing people to just go out and record everything that they do and then be able to build, test cases on top of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we actually started from open source, so our roots are having created a number of open source projects for software development lifecycle, like Cruise Control and Selenium and cruisecontrol.net, if some folks may be familiar with that. So open source has done a lot for us, and that it inspired us actually to go ahead and set up a commercial software business around application lifecycle management, just because we felt that there was a need for an extra level of attention, I guess, and polish that we were unable to give through just running an open source project. But I agree with the others. I mean, there's a huge amount to be learned from the way that these open source projects organize themselves and end up creating great software. We still open source a lot of the stuff that we create. So there's test load balancers. There's a number of pieces that we've open sourced just because we feel like we can get a better quality result through getting a larger user base and a larger set of feedback earlier on in the life cycle. So I still think, you know, open source has a big role to play in application lifecycle management, and you know, it, as the others have mentioned, it just can teach you a world about good software development practice and distributed teams.
Well, I think open source is definitely here to stay, and I think a lot of the what we consider right now the best practices evolved with open source. Mick talked about the style of automation that grew up around Mylan in order to make sure that contributions were worth taking, which is very similar to what we do in TFS gated check-in, which is, you know, a very high level of automation extent, you know, basically, you know, continuous integration on steroids, build before check-in. And that kind of very high level of automation and those kinds of agile practices, I think, grew up very much with open source because open source sort of pushed at scale some of these needs. We all benefit from it. So it was the transparency John mentioned, and the automation, and the idea that you could have this big community of developers. All of these things are good, and that you could have a broad community of reuse, and it could actually work. Uh-huh. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago that you really could have the level of reuse that we see today in software, and now it just works and it's accepted.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm seeing these two strategies for ALM vendors and just all the innovation around ALM that result from open source. One is to incorporate it. So there's been all this, you know, and the other one is to implement it, to use this as training wheels, you know, much like the Atlassian slapped a pretty face on the Bugzilla interaction model and that style of application, and it was extremely successful. Or the way that even, you know, it's like Apple will copy applications from its ecosystem and bring them into its platform. So using open source as training wheels to see what works in one kind of, you know, very large scale collaboration, hopefully learning the lessons of the things that don't work, like, you know, the fact that there is this sort of lack of planning, lack of long-term predictability. Mm-hmm. And now it's basically a question of, you know, whether the open source is brought into the stack and is a core part of the stack, and some of our work with HP is in bringing more open source into the ALM stack, and or whether it's offered by the stack so that you have, you know, some of the features in TFS blow away what's available right now in a stack that you put together in open source while providing that same style of development. So I think we'll see both of those strategies. And the good thing about it is that the impact of putting developers first and empowering them and giving them these lightweight tools, giving them the ability to always stay commit and make a contribution while not breaking up the build, so giving them that safety net, which are the things that, you know, those things that have had to be made to work in open source are now, have been transforming ALM as we see from mm-hmm. from these vendors.
Okay, so last question for you, because I know we're running out of time. In the whole domain of ALM, in the last 10 years, longer if you want, you know, it could be something new, relatively new, it could be something a long time ago. If there was an idea or a tool, not yours, or a book or anything that didn't get the appreciation, you know, at the time that it deserved, you know, a great idea or a great tool or something that would have really helped master some of these ALM challenges, feel free to point out one of those.
Don Reinertsen's book, Product Development Flow.
Why would you say that?
So I think, I don't know that it's ALM specific, so I think Reinertsen's book is probably the best distillation of why lean works and why things like small batch sizes reduce waste, and how to trace back from customer value to working practices. It's intended to be not just about software, but it directly applies to software, and you can map everything that we consider good practices and software to it. Mm. I think it's a really underappreciated book.
Any other candidates before we wrap up here?
It's a little bit abstract from your question, but one thing that always pained me, and I guess it's kind of coming into its own now, is that the object database actually didn't make it, that we got so fixated on relational databases and this idea that everything had to fit into some kind of relational structure. And I think that's badly affected the world of application lifecycle management, and it's made us think about the artifacts of application lifecycle management in a very relational way. It's made us think of a lot about a lot of data in a very relational way, and I think we're finally coming out of that as an industry, and we're coming up with these very restful approaches to our architecture and you know, this kind of NoSQL type movement. But I think the you know, I used to work for Sun Microsystems, actually, so I kind of blame Sun a little bit for the death of the object database, because we had this thing called entity beans, if anyone's familiar with the Java enterprise.
Yes.
And we just totally blew it. At a time when this really wonderful technology was coming out, we brought it into this container, and it was just a big mess. But the so I do think that kind of the resurgence of this NoSQL concept and this idea of very open data is an important piece to the next generation of application lifecycle management platforms, as well as obviously an important piece to the next generation of application architectures.
Last chance?
For me, it'd be David on top of my list. It would be David Allen's Getting Things Done. You know, the way that developed, you know, this. The personal productivity, the way that developers have to interact with an overloaded inbox of P0s or P1s, depending which company you work for, and just the amount of collaboration interruption they're dealing with, mean that the tools that we build for them for working with these, you know, this is a new generation of collaboration systems, right? We should be bringing the collaboration around software out of the Exchange server into TFS, out of Outlook into Visual Studio. And if you're going to do that, you need to start applying some of these productivity principles into the workflows in that new inbox, which is now the developer's desktop.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to end. Getting things done, I think, would be a good theme for a whole conference. So thank you all. This has been an excellent discussion, and thank you all for coming.